Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm an author and educator dedicated to empowering people to make informed food choices, to debunking myths about veganism, to being a voice for animals, and to giving people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and my newest book, On Being Vegan, Reflections on a Compassionate Life, which is available now as an ebook and a paperback. And I hope you'll like it. I think you will. I would be honored if you would let others know about it, spread the word, put a review up on your blog or on Goodreads or Facebook or Amazon, wherever you add reviews. So that's my latest book. And of course, as you know, I am the creator and host of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which gives you everything you need to make the transition healthfully, joyfully, and deliciously. And if you are already vegan, you will get a ton out of it. You can gift it to the veg curious in your life. You can go to 30dayveganchallenge.com. We just added a new premium level, which is very exciting. And I'm just getting a new recipe up for premium members. So check out the new video on the website, 30dayveganchallenge.com, which explains everything you need to know about the program. You can check out compassionatecook.com for all of my work. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook. Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/Patrick Goudreau. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/compassionatecooks. I think I'm also on Pinterest and all the other places, but I tend to dedicate my time when I am on social network sites, Facebook and Twitter. But you can find me elsewhere if you look, if you want to. Before I get started, of course, I would like to thank my amazing Platinum members, without whom I would not be able to do this podcast. I'm so grateful for their support. We have James Killen of Incentive Personal Training in Australia. Please check out his website at personal-training.com.au. We have Anonymous in Norway. You know who you are. Grace Rodriguez, thank you so much. Tim Anderson, David Cabrera, and Alexander Gray. Thank you both. And Alexander Gray Associates. Please check out alexandergray.com. Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City. That's peacefoodcafe.com. And Chris Hanna of Propagandi in Canada. That's Propagandi. I always say Propagandi. I feel like my New Jersey accent comes out. Propagandi, I'm sure, is the proper way to say it. I should check with you, Chris. Propagandi. So it's P-R-O-P-A and then Gandhi, G-A-N-D-H-I.com. And of course, Anonymous in Melbourne, Australia. You know who you are, and I thank you as well. I invite you to go to my website, compassionatecook.com, and under resources, you can check out the special members page. So if you ever want to go to the websites of the platinum and gold members that I mentioned, you can go to compassionatecook.com, go to resources, special members, and their websites are there. So I do invite you to do that. And we do have some new gold members, again, without whom I would not be able to do this podcast. Elizabeth Rotundo, Laura Hastings, and Joanna Sladovnik. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Joanna. Thank all of you for your support. If my memory serves, Elizabeth Rotundo, whose emails are signed Liz, is one of the organizers of the Albany Veg Fest in Albany, New York, which I'll be speaking at in November 2013. So thank you, Liz, for your support and for everything you do for the animals. And I have a brief but lovely email from Laura Hastings, who wrote, "Dear Colleen, thank you for your lovely podcast, website, books, and all of your work on behalf of animals. I've been slowly moving toward veganism, and with the encouragement of your work, I've finally made my way there. Thank you for leading the way. I am happy to support your work with my new gold membership. Thank you again for being such an amazing role model in how to live in line with my values. It's not easy, but you remind me daily that it's not only possible, but can be done with grace, compassion, and inclusion. Many thanks, Laura." Thank you so much, Laura. Thank you. And Charlie and Michiko are being very vocal, so you may hear them on today's episode. But apparently, Michiko and Charlie, thank you as well, Laura. We have a lovely email from Joanna, who wrote, "Colleen, After listening to so many stories on your podcast, I feel compelled to write a few words about myself. Although I found you after I became vegan, the precise situation about how I went vegan, my moment of awakening, is quite an interesting story in itself, but I'll save it for another time. And I read many excellent books on the subject and listened to many podcasts. I believe your work is particularly important, and I want you to be able to continue doing what you're doing for many years to come, at least until we finally reach a critical mass and see some major breakthroughs. I'm 47, and I've been vegan only for about a year, so it's taken me a long time to see the truth. Of course, I knew deep down something was not right, but there were too many forces pulling me in the opposite direction. Being vegan or even vegetarian seemed like an unattainable ideal. I tried once or twice, but without proper motivation or support, I could not stick with it. All the people in my life are very meat-oriented in their food choices and against any quote-unquote radical diets. At one point, I became interested in yoga, but even my yoga teacher talked in class about how she didn't believe in going to extremes and how she likes her burgers and steaks. Diabetes has been in my family for generations. My father just suffered a heart attack a few weeks ago and had bypass surgery. Everyone around me seems to be having issues with blood pressure, cholesterol, and something of that nature, but I'm the one with strange and dangerous eating habits. I'm originally from Poland, living in the U.S. for the past 20 plus years. Veganism is still extremely rare there, often considered a cult or an eating disorder. In fact, it often appears in that context in the press and television programs. My transition to veganism, once I had the right motivation, wasn't difficult, as I've been a longtime believer in plant-strong nutrition and addicted to green smoothies and juices. I even started a site dedicated to smoothies a few years ago called greenreset.com. That's also at compassionatecooks.com if you ever forget that. I have been building websites and doing internet marketing for several years now, and immediately after becoming vegan, I started posting information about veganism and vegan recipes on my blogs. I also began writing a guide for vegans who want to build their own successful website, posting it on my buildawebsiteacademy.com page. Even though I'm still uncomfortable discussing veganism with my family members, who often fiercely resist even a suggestion of eating a tofu dish or switching to almond milk in their coffee, I already feel like an activist. My dream is to help spread veganism via my websites in English and in Polish. Right now, all of my sites are in English, but eventually I'd like to create these materials in Polish. Maybe even recording a few podcasts for people to listen to. I love listening to your podcasts. I think there's something so intimate about them, like listening to a good friend. I'm letting people know about your podcast whenever I can. I'll be writing reviews of your books and podcasts and posting them on Amazon and elsewhere. Let me know if I can help you in any other way. Sincerely, Joanna. Thank you, Joanna. I just noticed that Michiko brought me her little carrot toy. She just carries her little carrot toy around and drops it at my feet at her leisure.
What are you doing?
Now I see why she's so vocal. She wants to tell me about her carrot. Okay, but it's not time now, Michiko. You tell me later. So thank you, Joanna. I'm sorry for the distraction. It's really hard. Michiko and Charlie are too cute, and it's hard to not get distracted. I really love what you're doing. I'm so excited by what you're doing, and I love being able to let people know about vegan resources in other languages. So please keep me posted on what you're doing regarding vegan resources in Polish. Last but not least, I thanked in my previous episodes Rachel O'Malley and Katie Brown, but I need to read their letters today. And then I will be all caught up and I won't be reading any letters from past members. We'll be all caught up. This is from Rachel O'Malley. She's a new gold member. I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, but I was vegan for over a year in 2008 and slowly went back to eating some animal products until recently. In 2007, after reading Diet for a New America, I immediately stopped eating chicken and seafood. I can't even remember the last time I ate red meat since I just never liked it. Then I found your podcast and Dr. Furman's podcast. After listening to your podcasts, specifically the ones about milk products and cheese, I became vegan. I was shocked that I was still contributing to the suffering of animals. At first, I was so determined never to eat animal products again, despite how socially difficult it was. As time went on, though, the criticisms I received from friends and family and the frustration I was going through during social situations, mainly eating plain green salads at restaurants, was having a major effect on me. I also felt sick and seemed to be gaining weight because I replaced the animal products with a lot of processed foods. I slowly began rationalizing eating things made with eggs, cheese, and milk. Then that turned into eating cheese and eggs. And then I started to eat fish. I felt so much inner guilt and regret every time I ate these things, but somehow I would push it away and continue. Nobody seemed to care what I was eating anymore, even though I was gaining weight and getting sick all the time. I'm not sure what made me wake up again, but I took all of my old books out of hiding and started listening to your podcast again. I'm proud to say that I'm vegan again, and I've lost over 40 pounds to date. I've done a lot of self-introspection to learn from all the mistakes I made before. I'm no longer ashamed to admit that I choose not to eat animals or their byproducts and educate people whenever the opportunity presents itself. I also hope to use my photography background someday to help the animals, although I don't see South Florida creating any farm sanctuaries in the future. You never know. You never know. I can't thank you enough for your work and dedication to get the word out and educate people on the truths of animal suffering. Your podcast and books are such a tremendous source of support for me, and I wanted to support you in any way I could. I pray that you are able to continue this work and expand your reach to radio and television. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Rach. Thank you, Rachel. I am working on it, you know, really working on trying to expand the audience. So keep holding that thought and we'll make it happen. And then we have a letter from Katie Brown. Katie Brown, who is a new Gold member I thanked in a previous episode, and I'm reading her letter now. Dear Colleen, I wanted to express my thanks for your podcast and offer a donation at this time. My boyfriend and I became vegan a month ago today after watching the documentary Veggiecated and seeing the cruelty to animals represented in that film. Prior to this, I had stopped eating both cows and dairy due to allergies. One day at work, through a search on vegan issues, I found your website. The podcast I Don't Eat Fake Meat caught my eye, and I listened and loved it. And since then, I was hooked. I had been calling my non-dairy alternatives fake and crinkling my nose when I explained them to others, although I find them a wonderful and delicious treat. I felt empowered to embrace my veganism and was armed with a new personal challenge to speak more kindly. Since then, I have listened to just about every podcast in all of my spare time, and I'm absolutely blooming with information thanks to your thoughtful research and helpful suggestions. I've had a few interactions with surly coworkers who claim to be carnivores, to which I have responded that we're all human, made up of the same stuff, that he isn't part lion, one of my favorite lines of yours, and the conversation ended with me getting in a few good points. I get nervous when the conversation turns to my veganism at work, because I sit very near five meat eaters, and it quickly becomes five against one. But knowing that you are there, linking me with the stories of other vegans, lets me know that I'm not alone. Immediately after that conversation, I listened to your podcast about talking to hunters, because the original attacker is, in his words, a harvester of animals. What a nice way of saying it, as if all you have to do is pluck them from the forest. I wanted to thank you specifically for your stance on talking to hunters. It's good to be reminded to be compassionate to our fellow humans as well as the animals, although it can sometimes be very difficult to exercise compassion in the face of rampant willful ignorance. Another of my favorite phrases of yours. Did you know you were so quotable? In addition to you giving me confidence and strength on a daily basis, I wanted to thank my boyfriend Nick for taking this journey with me. He hasn't listened to your podcast, but he has listened to excerpts from Vegan's Daily Companion and has let me explain all the new things I've learned from your podcast and has even let me cry when describing the story of the cow whose child was taken from her to be moved to shade and the distress it caused to the mother. I feel so deeply for the animals, and so does he, and I know we are forever changed by this decision. I feel so awakened to the plight of the animals and never want any harm to come to them for my own selfish pleasure ever again. Keep doing good work in the world, please, for all our sakes. Thank you again and again and again, Katie Brown in Norfolk, Virginia. Thank you so much, all of you, for these amazing letters. I'm so moved and I'm so grateful. And I'm speechless, but I can't be speechless for long because I'm doing a podcast that requires me to have speech. So honestly, thank you. All of you, all of the new Gold members, Platinum members, Silver members, all of the listeners, supporters, donors, all of you. If you find any value in this podcast, I urge you to consider supporting it. If you have ever referred anyone to it because you think it's a helpful resource, I urge you to consider supporting it. If you have ever quoted the podcast, I urge you to consider supporting it. If you've ever got anything out of it, I really urge you to become a member and support it. in any way that works for you. We have lots of options on the website. I really could not do this work without you. This is completely listener supported, and it's you who keeps it going. So please go to compassionatecook.com, click on the sign up button in the top right hand corner, or you can go to the podcast and there's support options there. You can just make a donation. You can become a monthly silver or a monthly gold or an annual silver or an annual gold or a monthly platinum or an annual platinum, whatever you prefer. So thank you. And let's get started. Oh, I have a very special story for you today called Adios Cordera. It was written in 1892 by Leopoldo Alas. He's also known as Clarín, however you want to say it. C-L-A-R-I-N. I'm going to refer to him as Clarín from now on. I will be reading a version translated into English, though, of course, it is very beautiful in Spanish and easy to find. So do look for it if you want to read it in Spanish. I will be reading it in English. Leopoldo Alas, Clarín, was born April 25th, 1852 in Zamora, Spain, and he died in 1901, June 13th, 1901 in Oviedo. He was a novelist, a journalist, and he was the most influential literary critic in late 19th century Spain. He was a proponent of liberalism and anti-clericalism, and his literary works are great examples of realism or naturalism. Clarín's most famous novel is called La Regenta, and it's considered one of the best novels of the 19th century. I admit I haven't read it, but I am anxious to. It's been said that Flaubert's Madame Bovary was one of its influences, so I am very interested in reading this book. Oviedo is the city in which Clarín lived and died and is buried, and in which La Regenta takes place. It's the capital city of a region in Spain called Asturias, A-S-T-U-R-I-A-S, near the north coast of Spain. And it's the only region of the Spanish peninsula that held off the Moorish invaders in the 8th century. This is the only region that did. So some consider it the true Spain because it was never influenced by the Moors. And I encourage you to go find Oviedo on a map. Oviedo is O-V-I-E-D-O. So you can see exactly where it's located, especially because you can see the location of it and other towns named in the story. And it just looks so beautiful. I've never been there, but after doing some research on it for this episode, I'm dying to go. You may have already seen a little bit of it if you have seen Woody Allen's, I think, 2008 film called Vicky Cristina Barcelona. This is the city Javier Bardem takes Rebecca Hall and Scarlett Johansson, the two women in the movie. He takes them to Oviedo for the weekend. So you can get a peek at it in that movie if you've seen that movie or if you want to see that movie. It looks like a very special city. It's known for its cleanliness. It's known for its churches. It's known for its statues and parks, the largest of which is San Francisco Park, which comprises 22 acres in the middle of the city. Not only is there a statue of Woody Allen just outside this park, within the park is a statue of the main characters in today's story. There's Cordera, the cow from our story, and Rosa and Pinin, the two children who loved her like a mother. I have a photo of it on my website, so go look at the page for this episode on my website and you can see a picture. It's a really beautiful statue and I love that it's memorialized, that the story is memorialized with the cow and the two children in a statue. Before I say more and then read the story, I just want to send a thank you to a podcast listener named Allison, who originally told me about this story. She read it for a Spanish literature class she was taking. And when I received Allison's recommendation, as I do with all recommendations, I transferred the text of her email to a document that I keep for such suggestions. In this case, I have one specifically for literary suggestions, but I never recorded her email address or her last name. And I have searched and searched my email and I just couldn't find the original. So please forgive me, Allison. I know it's Allison with one L. And if you are still listening, I am very grateful for the recommendation. It's an incredible story. And I really am afraid I'm not going to get through this without crying. I haven't been able to do so when I read it myself. And I've done so a few times, so I apologize in advance. But anyway, I promise there won't be any awkward, audible sobbing, I will turn it off before that happens. But I can't guarantee y'all won't hear evidence of some off mic tears. So thank you, Allison, wherever you are, for your recommendation. In short, Adios Cordera is the story of two children named Rosa and Pinin who love their family's cow named Cordera. It's pretty amazing because the author spends several pages explaining the intelligence and sweetness of the cow, even comparing Cordera's thoughts to those of the poet Horace, the great Roman lyric poet who lived from 65 BC to 8 BC. The family is very poor, and the father realizes that he must sell the beloved cow in order to pay rent. The children are heartbroken, and so is he. Now, what's so interesting to me is when you read critical responses of this story, you read things like, this is a story about saying goodbye and about how the progress of technology and society ruin the simple life that was once lived. Or this is a dystopian novel that deals with the rise of industrialization and modernity in Spain. Or this is a novel that criticizes the capitalism of the West, the need for money, the train and telegraph representing modernity and the transformation from an idyllic pastoral world to an industrial world. And that is all true. And as I've said before, art means whatever interpretation you bring to it. So there's not one way to look at the story. There's not one way. There's not a right way. There's not a wrong way. But just as with the critical response to, say, James Agee's story, I don't know if you remember that story I read, beautiful short story called A Mother's Tale, in which the female cow tells the little calves this horror story about the one who came back. And if you remember that, it's this beautiful story. I encourage you to go find it. It's called A Mother's Tale. It's by James Agee. And unfortunately, I had to remove it from the podcast because apparently I was infringing copyright by reading it. And the James Agee estate contacted me and they wouldn't respond in terms of, like, I asked them how much it would cost to keep it up so that I could pay, you know, a licensing fee. But I didn't hear back from them. And it's really unfortunate because it's one of my favorite stories. So yeah, these are the things that your support helps with, being able to get these stories on the air. Unfortunately, I had to take that one down. So go find it and read it yourself, A Mother's Tale. But my point is, and you may remember me saying this, I was really annoyed when I read the criticism of that story because all it focused on was how it was symbolic, how the cows were symbolizing something else. And it really wasn't just about the fact that there is this, you know, kind of straightforward story about the relationship. In the story that we're going to read today, the relationship between the people and the animals. But in James Agee's story, you know, the power of the railroad and industrialization and kind of mechanized slaughter, but just slaughter, just like that these animals have an awareness and that they're being used and they're being killed and how horrific it is. You know, no critic talks about that. So I'm here to talk about that. That's the lens through which I see everything. And that's the context in which I bring you these stories or any art form. Now, when you hear this story today or read it yourself, you will note how much reverence Clarín, the author, has for his characters, how aware he is of the intimacy of the relationship between the humans and Cordera, and how aware he is of the painful decision to sell an animal to slaughter. I find the story incredibly sensitive, insightful, and beautiful, not to mention incredibly painful. Now, the railroad does indeed play a major role as a symbol in this story, a symbol of the encroaching industrialization of our world. And I would be remiss if I didn't point you to a favorite novel of mine whose main theme is the same. I mentioned this book in the podcast episode called Big Vegan Finds in Little Places because I was talking about California. The novel is called The Octopus and it's by Frank Norris, who is a brilliant writer and unfortunately died very young from some stupid infection that he would have been saved from if there were antibiotics. So it was just really so sad. The title, The Octopus, refers to the many winding tracks on a railroad map comprised of many outstretched arms. So that's the illusion. That's what the octopus refers to. It's called The Octopus, The Story of California, and it was published in 1901, and it was supposed to be the first of a trilogy he called The Epic of Wheat, which dramatizes the conflicts between homesteaders, farmers, Ranchers and the Railroad. And the book is based on a true story that occurred in 1880, in which there was a bloody battle between ranchers and the Southern Pacific Railroad. One of the things that interests me about the railroad and the move west is not just the fact that people were exploited and taken advantage of, but that with the railroad, people and cattle were able to be more easily transported dead and alive. And that's what we have here in Adios Cordera. So it really reminds me of the octopus. And, you know, they're tackling the same subjects. So these are the same issues wherever you are. But I love the octopus so much. And I love Adios Cordera so much. So the only other thing I wanted to mention when you hear the story is to clarify the meaning and significance of the mention of the Ramayana. It's one of the great epics of India. It's ascribed to the Hindu sage Valmiki, and it forms an important part of the Hindu literature. The Ramayana is dated from somewhere between 500 and 100 BC. So you'll hear that mentioned. I just wanted to give you some context for that. So with that, Adios Cordera. The three of them, always the three of them, Rosa, Pinin, and Cordera. Simonte Meadow was a triangular parcel of green velvet spread out like a drapery at the base of a small hill. The lower angle sprouted in close proximity to the railway line from Oviedo to Gijón. A telegraph pole left there as a banner of conquest, with its little white insulation cups and parallel lines to the right and left, represented for Rosa and Pinin the big, wide, mysterious, frightening, eternally ignored world. Pinin, after thinking the matter over at great length and watching for days on end how the quiet, inoffensive pole stood so open to the world, and noticing how in its desire to fit in the village it did everything in its power to take on a resemblance to an ordinary tree, dared draw closer until he became confident enough to wrap his arms around the wood and climb toward the lines. But he never managed to touch the porcelain at the top, which reminded him of the small cups he had seen at the parish house in Puao. Seeing himself so close to a sacred mystery brought on a feeling of panic, and he slid fast down the pole until his feet touched the ground. Rosa, less audacious, but more taken with the idea of the unknown, was content to bring an ear close to the telegraph pole. She would listen for minutes on end, even entire quarter hours, to the formidable metallic sounds the wind extracted from the fibers of the dry pine where they came in contact with the wires. The vibrations, at times intense, like those of a tuning fork, and that seemed to burn with the giddying beat of a flame when heard close up, were for Rosa the papers that passed, the letters transmitted on the threads, the incomprehensible language the unknown wrote to the unknown. She felt little need to understand what the people in one far-off place had to say to others in the opposite end of the world. What did it matter to her? She was only interested in the sound for the sound's sake, in its tone and its mystery. Cordera, so much more formal than her companions and much more mature in years, too, kept her distance from the civilized world and looked at the telegraph pole from afar, as if at an inanimate thing not even worth scratching against. She had lived through a great deal, on all fours for hours upon hours, an expert in pastures. She knew how to make use of her time. She meditated more than she ate and enjoyed living in peace beneath the gray, tranquil sky of her country, as if she were succoring her soul, something that even the brutes of this world possess. Were the idea not profane, it would even be possible to say that the matronly cow's thoughts, which derived from much experience, resembled Horace's most calming doctrinal odes. Like a grandmother, she took part in the games of the shepherd boys given the task of taking her to pasture. Had she been able to, she would have smiled at the thought that Rosa and Pinin's task in the field was to care for her, Cordera, to see she did not wander too far or go near the railway track or leap into the adjoining property. Why leap? Why go astray? To graze a little from time to time, but every day a little bit less, without bothering to lift her head out of idle curiosity, choosing the choicest mouthfuls. Afterwards, to rest on her hindquarters with delight, contemplate life, and enjoy the pleasure of not suffering. Anything else would be a dangerous adventure. She could not remember when a fly had last bitten her. The bull, the crazy, leaps through the fields, all that was a distant memory. Her peace had only been disturbed on the inauguration of the railway. The first time Cordera saw a train pass by, she went berserk. She leapt Simonte's tallest hedge and ran through the adjacent fields. Her fright lasted days, returning with more or less the same intensity every time a train appeared on the line. Little by little, she grew accustomed to the innocuous racket. When she managed to convince herself that the danger always passed, that the threatened catastrophe never came to be, she took no more precaution than to rise on all fours and gaze straight ahead, her head raised at the formidable monster. Later, she did no more than look at it without rising, with antipathy and distrust. Eventually, she reached the point of not bothering to gaze at the train. For Rosa and Pinin, the novelty of the railway left lasting, pleasant impressions. If at the start it was a crazy kind of happiness mixed with superstitious fear, a form of nervous excitement that brought on shouts and gestures and wild pantomimes, later it was peaceful and gentle recreation, renewed several times a day. It took a long time to expend the emotion of watching the giddying transit, accompanied by the wind of the great iron snake that carried with it so much noise and the faces of so many unknown strange people. However, the telegraph, the railway, all this really amounted to a momentary accident that drowned in the sea of solitude surrounding Simonte Meadow. No human dwelling could be seen from there, and the only sound that could be heard from the outside world was that of the passing train. On endless mornings, beneath the occasional rays of the sun, among the buzzing insects, the cow and the children awaited the onset of midday and the return to the house that followed. And later, the eternal afternoons of sweet, sad silence in the same field until night fell, its evening brilliance silent witness at the heights. The clouds gathered, trees cast shadows, birds perched among the rocks in the ridges and ravines. Some stars began shining in the darkest sections of blue sky, and Pinin and Rosa, the twins, Anton and Chinta's children, holding on to the sweet, dreamlike serenity of solemn, serious nature, remained quiet for hours on end after their games, never exceptionally rowdy at any time, seated near Cordera, who punctuated the August silence of the afternoons with the pointed sound of a sluggish cowbell. In this silence, this calm, undisturbed by activity, there was love. The twins loved each other like two halves of a ripe fruit, united by the same life, with scant consciousness of what made them distinct from one another or of what separated them. Pinin and Rosa loved Cordera, the big, yellow, grandmotherly cow, the nape of whose neck resembled a cradle. Cordera would have reminded a poet of the Zavala of the Ramayana, the sacred cow, in the abundance of her form, the solemn serenity of her deliberate, noble movements, her air and contours of a dethroned, fallen idol, pleased with her fortune, happier to be a real cow than a false god. Cordera, to the degree that it may be possible to guess such things, would have said too that she loved the twins charged with the task of grazing her. She wasn't that expressive, but the patience with which she submitted to the twins' games, in which she variously served as pillow, hiding place, saddle, and whatever else accorded with the children's fantasies, silently demonstrated the affection of the peaceful, thoughtful animal. In difficult times, Pinin and Rosa had gone to incredible lengths to care for Cordera. Anton had only recently acquired the meadow. Years before, Cordera had to graze as best as she could at random along the roads and narrow streets of the sparse meadows of the community, comprised as much of public thoroughfares as pasture. In such days of penury, Panine and Rosa guided her to the prime hillocks, to the quietest and least heavily grazed places, thus liberating her from the thousand abuses to which poor animals forced to leave their search for food to chance on the road are exposed. In the most difficult days in the barn, when the hay was scarce and the corn stalks used to make a warm bed for the cow were also lacking, Cordera owed the amelioration of her misery to the inventiveness of Rosa and Pinin. And what can one say about the time of calving and the breeding, when the needs of the offspring conflicted with the Chintos' interest, which consisted of robbing from the udders of the poor mother the entire quantity of milk, with the exception of what was adequately indispensable for the survival of the calf. At such times, Rosa and Pinin always sided with Cordera, and whenever they found the opportunity, secretly set the suckling free. The creature, blind and as if crazed, bumping against everything, ran to the shelter of the mother, who lodged him under her belly and turned her grateful, diligent head, saying in her way, "Let the children and the sucklings come to me." Such memories, such ties are among those never forgotten. Also, no cow in the whole world could have been better tempered or more patient than Cordera. Whenever she found herself paired with a companion attached to the yoke, she bowed her will to what was alien to her, and hour after hour found her with neck bent, head twisted in an uncomfortable position on her feet, while her yoke mate slept on the ground. Antone understood that he was destined for a life of poverty when he came face to face with the fact that he would never realize his golden dream of acquiring a farm of his own with at least two heads of cattle. By dint of hard labor and unstinting privation, he eventually saved enough to purchase his first cow, Cordera. And that was that. He would not be able to buy a second until he paid arrears to the landlord, the owner of the little house that he rented, and carried off to the market that piece of his insides, Cordera, the love of his children. Within 2 years of Cordera's arrival at the house, Chinta died. The cow's shed and the double bed shared a wall, that is, a partition comprised of the branches of chestnut trees and corn stalks. Chinta, muse of the miserable house's poverty, died looking at the cow through a hole in the divide, pointing her out as the salvation of the family. "Take care of her. She's your bread and butter," the eyes of the poor moribund appeared to say. She died debilitated by hunger and work. The twins had focused their love on Cordera. The mother's lap exudes a particular affection that a father cannot compete with. The children sought it now in the warmth of the cow, in the shed, and in the field. Antone understood all this in his confused way. He did not have to say a word to the children about the need to sell the cow. Early one Saturday in July, in a bad mood, Antone began walking toward Guillon. Cordera, who had only the bell around her neck in front of him. Pinin and Rosa slept. Other days, he had to practically whip them awake. On this day, he left them alone. When they awoke, they discovered that Cordera had gone. Papa's taken her to the bull. No other conjecture occurred to them. Pinin and Rosa believed the cow went with reluctance. They thought she wished for no more offspring, because she always ended up losing them soon, without knowing how or when. At dusk, Antone and Cordera entered the yard in front of the house, gloomy, tired, and covered in dust. Their father said nothing, though the children guessed the danger. He had not made the sale because nobody agreed to the price he asked. It was excessive. His affection for the beast clouded his reason. He asked so much for the cow to ensure nobody would dare take her away. The men who approached, intending to obtain a good deal, soon moved off, cursing the one who looked with rancor and defiance at those among them who insisted on nearing the price that Antone obstinately maintained. Until the last minute of the day, Antone was in the humidor, leaving the matter to fate. "It can't be said," he thought, "that I don't want to sell the cow. It's that they don't want to pay what Cordera's worth." Finally, with a sigh, if not exactly satisfied, but with a certain relief, he turned and started walking along the Kandas Road, among the confusion and noise of bullocks and pigs, oxen and cows, which the villagers from many parishes in the district conducted with greater or lesser exertion, in accord with the length of time the men and beasts had been acquainted. At a crossing at Narahoyo, it seemed as though Anton might yet lose the cow. A neighbor from Carrió, who had pestered him the whole day, offering a price just a few duros less than that asked, and who was now rather drunk, made a final attack. He bid higher and higher, torn between greed and the whim of owning the cow. But Anton held firm as a rock. They ended up with their hands joined, standing in the middle of the road, blocking the way. Finally, greed triumphed. The amount of 50 duros separated them like an abyss. They let go of each other's hands, and each went his own way. Anton followed a lane adorned with honeysuckles that had not yet bloomed and budding blackberries, and led her to the house. From the day they surmised the danger of the situation, Panin and Rosa did not rest. In the middle of the week, the steward showed up at Anton's yard. He was another villager from the same parish, a short-tempered man known for his cruelty toward tenants who fell behind in their payments. Anton, who did not stand for his reprimands, turned livid when the other threatened him with eviction. The landlord would not wait longer. In that case, Anton would sell the cow at a low price for the equivalent of a light snack. It was either that or the streets. The following Saturday, Panin accompanied his father to the humedal. The child looked horrified at the meat dealers, who were the tyrants of the place. A man from Castile bought Cordera for a just price. Branded, she returned to her shed in Puau. Already sold, somebody else's, her bell sadly ringing. A sullen Anton walked behind her with Panin, whose eyes were swollen. When she heard about the sale, Rosa wrapped her arms around Cordera's neck. She inclined her head at the caresses, just as she did when they submitted her to the yoke. There goes the old girl, the unsociable Anton thought to himself, broken-hearted. She's an animal, but his children had no other mother or grandmother. The silence of the following days in the field and in Simonte's greenery hung funereal. Ignorant of her fate, Cordera rested and grazed as usual, apparently unconscious of the passage of time, as she would rest and eat a minute before the brutal cudgel killed her. But Rosa and Panin lay grief-stricken upon the grass, which would soon be good for nothing. They gazed with rancor at the passing trains, the wires of the telegraph pole. It was that unknown world, so far from them on both sides, that would take Cordera away from them. When it grew dark on Friday, it was time for the goodbye. An agent of the new owner came for the animal. He paid and took a drink with Anton, and they brought Cordera to the little square. Anton had drained the bottle. He was in a highly excited state. The weight of the money in his pocket further enlivened his spirits. He wanted to blind himself. He spoke a lot, singing the praises of the cow. The other man smiled because it was impertinent of Anton to go on in this fashion. Who cared if the cow provided so much milk, that she was noble in the yoke, strong when heavily burdened? So what if in a matter of days she was going to be turned into chops and other delicious cuts? Anton did not want to imagine that. He thought of her alive, working, serving another laborer, having forgotten him and the children, but alive and happy. Panin and Rosa sat holding hands atop a mound of fertilizer, a sentimental reminder for them of Cordera and their own work, looking at the enemy with terrified eyes. At the last moment, they threw themselves on top of their friend, kisses, embraces, everything. They could not release her. Anton, now that the effect of the wine had worn off, fell as if in a marasmus. He folded his arms and entered the darkened yard. The children followed for a good distance, along the narrow street with high hedges. The sad group of the indifferent agent and Cordera, who accompanied the unknown man unwillingly and at such an hour. Finally, Rosa and Panin had to abandon their pursuit. In a fit of pique, Anton shouted from the house, "Children, come here. That's enough foolishness." So the father employed from a distance in a tearful voice. Night fell. The high hedges along the darkened, narrow lane appeared black, practically forming a vault. They lost sight of the vague shape of Cordera, who seemed equally black from afar. In a moment, there remained nothing of her but the slow tinkle of a bell, a sound that faded little by little in the distance among the sad creaks of countless cicadas. "Goodbye, Cordera," cried Rosa, overcome with weeping. "Goodbye, my love." "Goodbye, Cordera," repeated Pinin, equally distraught. "Goodbye," the bell answered at last, after its fashion, the sad refrain coming apart, resigned among the sounds of the July night in the village. Very early the next day, at the regular hour, Pinin and Rosa went to Simonte Meadow. For them, the solitude encountered there had never been sad, but that day, without Cordera, the Simonte resembled a desert. Suddenly, the locomotive whistled, smoke appeared, and then the train. In a closed wagon, in narrow high windows or air vents, the twins glimpsed the heads of cows that peered, bewildered, through the openings. "Goodbye, Cordera," said Rosa, imagining her friend, the grandmotherly cow there. "Goodbye, Cordera," yelled Pinin, with the same faith, brandishing his fist at the train which flew toward Castile. The tearful boy, more conscious than his sister of the villainy of the world, cried out, "They're taking her to the slaughterhouse. Beef for the gentlemen, priests, for those who've come back rich from America. Goodbye, Cordera. Goodbye, Cordera." Rosa and Pinin gazed with rancor at the railway line and the telegraph, symbols of a malevolent world that snatched from them, that devoured their companion of so many solitary hours, of so much silent tenderness, to gratify the appetites and convert her into the food of rich gluttons. "Goodbye, Cordera. Goodbye, Cordera." Many years passed. Pinin grew into a young man and received a summons from the king. The Third Carlist War raged. Anton was a farm manager for a local boss of the defeated party, but it would have been futile for him to declare his son unfit for duty. Besides, Pinin was like an oak. One sad afternoon in October, Rosa waited alone in Simonte Meadow for the mail train from Gijón. It carried with it her only love, her brother. The locomotive whistled in the distance, and then the train passed along the cutting in a flash. Rosa, nearly caught up in the wheel, saw for an instant, in a third-class coach, the heads of numerous poor conscripts, crying out and gesticulating, greeting the trees, the soil, the fields, and everything about their mother country that was familiar to them, their local areas, everything left behind to go and die in the fratricidal conflicts of the country as a whole, in the service of a king and ideas they had no knowledge of. Pinin, half his body out the window, spread out his arms toward his sister. They almost touched. Rosa heard the clear voice of her brother among the noise of the wheels and the shouts of the recruits. He sobbed, exclaiming, as though prey to a distant memory of pain, "Goodbye, Rosa. Goodbye, Cordera. Goodbye, Pinin, my love." There he goes, like the other, like the grandmotherly cow. He goes into the world, beef for the gluttons, for those who return rich from America, flesh of her soul, cannon fodder for this world's craziness, for the ambitions of others. So ran the train of Rosa's thought among a riot of pain and ideas as she watched the train disappear in the distance, whistling sadly, whistles that echoed in the chestnut trees, the valleys, and among the boulders. How alone she felt. Now, yes, now Simonte Meadow resembled a desert. Goodbye, Pinin. Goodbye, Cordera. With what hatred did Rosa gaze at the tracks stained with burnt coal? With what rage did she appraise the telegraph wires? Oh, Cordera had chosen well never to go near them. That was the world, the unknown, which swallowed everything. And without realizing what she was doing, Rosa leaned her head against the pole that stood like a banner at the extremity of the Simonte. The wind sang its metallic song in the entrails of the dry pine. Now Rosa understood. It was a tearful refrain of abandonment, of solitude, of death. In the rapid vibrations, like moans, she thought she heard very far off the voice that sobbed on the line ahead of her, "Goodbye, Rosa. Goodbye, Cordera." For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick Goodrow. Thanks for listening.